Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, if you're against Scottish independence, would you boycott Scotch if tomorrow Scots vote to break away from the UK?
I'll believe that one when I see it. But first to Capitol Hill, where the House is preparing to vote on a bill called the Continuing Resolution to Fund the Government until after the midterm elections, right into December. It is expected to pass, and Senate leaders say they're optimistic it'll pass in the upper chamber this week as well. But it's not the temporary spending bill that's getting all the attention and debate on Capitol Hill. It's an amendment to that bill that would give the president the authority to have the U.S. military arm and train moderate Syrian rebels to combat ISIS. Today, President Obama spoke from MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa, Florida, to rally support around that plan, which he laid out last week.
Our armed forces are unparalleled and unique. And so when we got a big problem somewhere around the world, it falls on our shoulders. And sometimes that's tough. But that's what sets us apart. That's why we're America.
NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith joins us from Capitol Hill with more on this. And Tamara, what else did the president have to say today?
You know, the remarks started out almost like a rally. He was in a gymnasium with about 1,200 service members, and it really did have the feel of a rally, of building support. There was hooting and cheering, and really building support for this strategy that he has rolled out. And at one point, he repeated something similar to something he said before about ISIS, the Islamic State. He said, "You will find no safe haven. We will find you eventually." And the room just broke out into cheers. He also made a very firm commitment, basically looking in the eyes of people who could be sent into action, saying, "I will commit to you that we will not fight another ground war like the Iraq war was." Once again, trying to make it clear that he has no interest in an extended ground engagement of sending in ground troops.
Well, and I want to get to that in a few minutes. But first, let's talk about what's happening where you are on Capitol Hill and this rare bit of bipartisan agreement in the House and Senate. Kind of unusual that both houses are expected to pass a bill to fund the government.
Absolutely. It's funny. Nobody's even really talking that much about the part of this bill that will fund the government. You know, this time last year, we were on our way to a government shutdown that ultimately happened and lasted 17 days over the very same kind of temporary, let's just keep the government open for a little while kind of a bill. Now, they're barely even talking about it, and they absolutely expect without any difficulty to pass a bill keeping the government open and functioning only through December. Then they'll come back and work on something a little bit longer term. But this is a, you know, sort of a classic congressional punt where they, you know, the term kick the can down the road, which I hate. But that's what they're doing. They're putting off bigger decisions and not having a big fight about it.
But what about this amendment that would fund the arming and training of Syrian rebels? Not everyone in the House and Senate are in agreement on that. We just spoke with Senator Begich from Alaska the other day, a Democrat, who says he doesn't agree with that idea.
Oh, and there are many people. It's interesting. There's both bipartisan unity in support of it, and there's also bipartisan unity against it. Now, they don't necessarily agree on the reasons why they're opposed, but this is not going to be a slam dunk vote overwhelmingly passed. There are a whole lot of people who have a whole lot of concerns about this idea of arming Syrian rebels. Earlier today on the Senate floor, Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia, who's a Democrat, said, "I'm afraid that a few years from now, we'll be up here talking about the next threat, the next terrorist group, and they're going to have the weapons that we gave to the Syrian rebels." There's a lot of concern about the strategy and specifically about arming folks who, you know, it's not entirely clear who all the good guys are in Syria.
Well, let's talk about that strategy. And you brought this up that yesterday the Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Martin Dempsey testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee, and he alluded to the possibility that boots on the ground would be necessary down the road. Today, though, President Obama was very clear in saying that would not happen. Let's listen.
"As your commander-in-chief, I will not commit you and the rest of our armed forces to fighting another ground war in Iraq. After a decade of massive ground deployments, it is more effective to use our unique capabilities in support of partners on the ground so they can secure their own country's futures. And that's the only solution that will succeed over the long term.
So what about that, Tamara? Because there are many people saying you can't just do this with airstrikes and you can't just do it with rebel fighters on the ground.
And I think it's also important to talk about what General Dempsey actually said. What he said was, I think this strategy is going to work, but if it doesn't, there may come a time when I might have to recommend to the president that ground troops be sent in. What he wasn't saying is that right now he's recommending it. But that is a debate that's happening in Congress. Some people are very afraid of the idea of sending ground troops in. Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi in the House, who is urging fellow Democrats to vote in favor of arming the Syrian rebels, said that if Congress was asked to send in ground troops, she would absolutely vote no. And she's pretty sure every Democrat would vote along with her in that direction. But there are many people like Senator John McCain and other Republicans, especially, who say we need to seriously consider sending in ground troops, or at least have the possibility, not foreclose on that possibility, or at least be able to send in special forces to do limited operations. Though it seems kind of clear to me that the Obama administration believes they already have the authority to do that kind of thing, which they did in an attempt to save James Foley, though that obviously was not a successful mission.
NPR's Tamara Keith on Capitol Hill. Tamara, thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, to Scotland now, where six simple words could prove to be historic tomorrow. Should Scotland be an independent country? That's the question in the referendum. Polls show the vote tied, and both sides are hoping to convince anyone still on the fence. Former Prime Minister Gordon Brown urged Scots to vote no.
The real way to change is not to separate off Scotland from the rest of the United Kingdom, but to have a stronger Scottish Parliament with the powers that we want it to have on a timetable that is quick and will deliver swiftly to the people of Scotland.
But Nicola Sturgeon, Deputy First Minister of Scotland, told the BBC that separation is the answer.
If we want to guarantee the powers that we need to protect our public services, create jobs and opportunities, make sure we never again get Tory governments we don't vote for, then the way to do that is to vote yes.
If the vote is yes for independence, how would Scotland fare economically? Whiskey is Scotland's biggest export after oil and gas, and so strongly associated with the country that many people around the world just call it Scotch. So how might a yes vote affect the rapidly growing Scotch whiskey industry? That's the question the BBC's John Lawrenson asked.
At the site near Edinburgh Airport, where he's building a big new whisky distillery, businessman George Stewart declaims a passage from the Declaration of Arbroath, the 14th century document many see as the founding moment of the Scottish nation. This Falkirk distillery is costing £5 million to build, some of which is being provided in the form of a grant from the Scottish Government. Mr. Stewart is hoping for a yes.
I would like to think it could be good for Scotland, gives a bit more independence, to be able to decide our own taxes, what we can do with them.
Are you worried about a backlash in England? People deciding, well, I don't want to buy their whiskey if they want to separate from us?
I have no fear about that whatsoever. If they like whiskey, they'll drink whiskey. And they're making their own whiskey, which unfortunately, because we're on tape, I daren't say what it's like.
In any case, the British whisky drinkers, like the ones in this Edinburgh pub, are not nearly as important to the industry as they used to be. According to the latest figures, Scotch whisky exports rose 22% last year to £3.5 billion, with exports rising 64% to Singapore, 56% to Brazil, and 45% to Taiwan. Russia is a big market, so is Japan, and the French now spend even more money on Scottish whisky than the British spend on French wine. But, says the No Camp, the fact that whisky sales are booming around the world is one reason Scotland must remain in the UK.
Smoke, a creamy mouthfeel, roasted chestnuts, licorice and a salty sherry top note.
David Wishart, lecturer in marketing at the University of Edinburgh Business School, reads from the book he wrote, now in its third edition, about choosing whiskies by flavour. He believes a yes vote will have very negative consequences for Scotland.
I'm sure that Scotland will continue to produce Scotch whisky, but the industry itself, I think, might well move to London. We already have two of the largest producers, Diageo and Pernod Ricard, who have headquarters outside of Scotland, and others like William Grant's and Edrington Group might well decide to relocate, as indeed RBS and Lloyd's and Standard Life are contemplating relocating to London in the event of a yes vote.
The risk, says Dr. Wishart, is that they'll prefer the security of continuing to sell whisky in pounds than the uncertain currency future of an independent Scotland. The Scotch Whisky Association said recently that the consequences of independence would be damaging and difficult to manage, pointing up the increased cost and bother of having to deal with two tax and regulatory systems. Historically, Scottish whisky makers have found it hard enough dealing with one.
That's where we source the water from.
Oh, wonderful.
You can just see the top of Roneval there.
Yeah.
Next stop is America. That's right on the west coast of Lewis.
Mark Taburn has set up what is the first whisky distillery in the Outer Hebrides, the first legal one at least. And you've got the stream just rushing down here just next to us.
Oh, well, you can
That's
hear
a
it.
Beautiful brook. Does it make a difference, the water?
Oh, it makes a big difference. We've got no... There's no agriculture up there, there's no housing, there's nothing.
Right.
It might be a dead deer or a dead sheep, but that'll give a wee taste to your dram, like, you know?
Out here in the wild west of Scotland, it wasn't long ago that people would make their own whisky. The word moonshine comes from here, because the people made whisky at night so the excise man wouldn't see the smoke from his stills. Here, there's a good deal of scepticism about politicians, whether they're based in London or Edinburgh. This, for instance, is Mark Taburn on whether independence would strengthen the brand identity of Scottish whisky.
I don't know if it would or if it wouldn't, like, because Scotland kind of stands up anyway. It's never been like United Kingdom. It's always been Scotland, England, Ireland, Wales. So, yes, I would like to see independence, but I don't want to see a bunch of suits trying to do this bloody William Wallace thing or whatever it is. You know, I mean, that's in the past, and that's what it should be. Well, okay.
No more Mel Gibson doing Braveheart, then. If independence comes, this whisky maker hopes that the suits, as he calls them, from both sides of the border, can do some cool-headed sitting down and working out how to keep the whisky trade strong, whether they have to count it in pounds, in euros, or in Scottish groats.
The BBC's John Lawrenson in Scotland. Fascinating about moonshine there, because the Scots then brought it to Appalachia. In the southwest, they're stacking sandbags to protect homes from potential flash flooding. Tropical storm Odile is expected to pour up to 9 inches of rain on parts of Arizona and New Mexico. In Tucson, some schools have canceled classes and field trips. Jim Cantore, meteorologist with the Weather Channel, is live in Tucson. And Jim, what are people there expecting? Because we saw those pictures as Odile went through parts of the coast of Mexico, people taking cover in hotel conference rooms. So, you know, how are people there feeling?
Well, I mean, we got to understand that that was a wind. I mean, that was a true hurricane coming through there. That was the wind and power of a hurricane. But what's happened is that's weakened considerably. So we're just expecting the moisture here in the southwest, which, as you know, hurricanes can produce wind and a lot of water as well. And we're going to get the water part up here. But just about a week ago, we had Hurricane Norbert that worked its way off the coast, but the moisture spread up here, and we had tremendous flooding in Phoenix, in Tucson, and this is fresh in everybody's minds. So they're obviously being very proactive in closing the schools and hoping that atmosphere doesn't repeat itself like it did last Monday.
Well, I guess that's the question, because we know Odile is bringing this rain. Some are saying it would be historic rain, and we know that the ground is too dry to accept it in some parts of the city. So what do you think about that word historic?
Well, I mean, it's tough to pinpoint exactly where this rain falls. But to put that into perspective for you and where I think they're coming from is some of these rainfall forecasts are what these areas see in a year, not in 24 hours.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's what makes it historic if it verifies. Some areas will flood. Some areas will get a half inch of rain. Some areas, sadly, may get that 9 inches of rain.
Yeah.
And that's what we're watching for right now. This event is underway. It's going to last through probably Friday morning. And it seems right now that extreme southeastern Arizona and New Mexico are going to be hit hardest.
Well, meanwhile, we understand something else is brewing in the Pacific. Tropical storm Polo?
Tropical storm Polo on the verge of becoming a hurricane. Very concerned that if this does intensify further than forecast, it could do what O'Deal did and move closer to Cabo and threaten them first. That would be by this weekend, again, potentially with another wind event and heavy rain event, flood event with the waves, and then maybe into the southwest again early next week. Yeah. So not only have we never had two tropical systems impact the southwest within 10 days, never. The fact that we could actually have three is rather unprecedented.
Oh boy. Okay, but let's concentrate on today with rain potentially up to 9 inches in some areas. Be careful of the roads you're driving on there that turn into aqueducts and just take care. Jim Cantore, meteorologist with the Weather Channel, live from Tucson, Arizona, waiting for that rain to come in. Jim, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, meanwhile, in north-central Washington, people are still recovering from the largest wildfire in that state's history. The Carlton Complex fire burned more than 250,000 acres, destroyed at least 350 homes. Ranchers were hard hit. Some lost hundreds of head of cattle. Then came rains and mudslides there. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, Anna King has the story of a fifth-generation rancher and how he survived the natural disasters, but at a cost.
When Kent Stokes returned to survey the ruins of his burnt-up shop and home, he was happy to find at least his cat survived the Carlton Complex wildfires.
I hear him meowing through the brush or whatever that was left, and he came running out. He was fine, not a singe mark on him. Yeah, he was definitely happy to see me and get a meal for sure. So, but yeah, that was kind of a win.
Another win? His parents' house survived the fire. That's where he lives now. But the losses are crushing. The fire stripped about 20,000 acres of his family's grazing land. Stokes crawls up the steep hillsides and deep canyons in a pickup truck. As a boy, he learned how to find his way out here. The rocks, creeks, trees, they're the backcountry signposts. But now in this cooked landscape of ash and gaping earth,
Most all that's gone and different. And when I was riding up there looking for survivors, it was pretty easy for me to get lost or turned around because I just didn't recognize where I was at anymore.
The fire lasted for 5 nights on the Stokes place. They had to decide what to save first. Massive stacks of winter hay, shops, barns, tractors, several family homes, and even the animals they depend on. After, Stokes came upon a cow. He knew her well by her ear tag.
Her skin looked like an elephant, kind of just gray and all wrinkly and everything.
The burnt-over cow was having trouble breathing, and she wouldn't move back toward the ranch.
Well, personally, because she had that will to live, I would have liked to try to give her a chance, but, the merciful thing was just to put a bullet in her and end it right then and there, so that's what we did.
It's got to be hard, though. I'm sure you care about your mamas. And
yeah, that was definitely tough, and, especially a good cow like that.
The Stokes family lost 215 head of cattle this year, and all those bloodlines are gone. Stokes explains that he can't just go out and buy more to replace them.
We have long, cold winters, but we also have long, hot summers. So you can't just have a cow with thin skin or something. He has to be able to tolerate weather extremes. He has to be able to travel several miles to water and go out there and find that forage and take her calf along.
Stokes says building back those hardy traits for life here could take decades.
People driving along a highway that see some cows out there, some black cows, they can say, oh, they all look alike or they're all the same. But, I guess when it's your job or you've grown up around it, there's a little minute differences in every animal.
Some of the smallest survivors were 4 calves. When I visited, the animals were bedded down in tall, cool grass near a quiet creek.
This is the worst calf right here. You can see. I mean, your feet are just, burnt down to nubs.
Stokes had been smearing his calves with medical salve and doling out pain meds. What we didn't know was, at nightfall, gully washers and torrents of mud would barrel down this canyon. The storm washed away corrals Stokes had just built. 2 irrigation pumps for alfalfa are gone, One of those injured calves was even swept away. Stokes says the grass will eventually come back better. The trees and shrubs will come back too.
It's just a matter of how long. And that's kind of the tough thing for us, is we're so dependent on the land for our livelihood.
And living off the land means you're on Mother Nature's clock. These are the last days of summer. Time is running low. There's hay to put up and 20 miles of fence to build before the ground freezes. Then the snow melts. Then spring and more mud. And with the hillside stripped bare, the mud could come down in waves for years. For Here and Now, I'm Anna King, outside of Twisp, Washington.
Tough, tough work.
Today marks 3 years since this sound was heard around the world. Members of the Occupy Wall Street movement, which took over New York's Zuccotti Park 3 years ago, protesters railed against what they saw as greed and corruption on Wall Street, but they soon had to leave Zuccotti Park and their movement fell from the front pages. Well, today the group is focusing on something else, student loan debt. Cardiff Garcia of the Financial Times joins us from New York. And Cardiff, Occupy organizers announced today that they've abolished about $4 million in student loan debt through their strike debt initiative. We should say, of course, student loan debt is totaling, what, $1 trillion now. But tell us more about what they're up to today.
Yeah, I mean, so this was kind of an interesting thing. The group itself is an offshoot of the original Occupy movement. Essentially, what they're doing is they're trying to bring some publicity to their wider goal of making college cheaper and eventually, hopefully, making higher education free. And so, you know, this $4 million number, they paid about $100,000, I think, to abolish the debt of some of these debtors who'd taken out money essentially to go to these for-profit colleges, which basically just ripped them off. They're being sued now by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And so I think this is a pretty interesting example of how this group is, you know, trying to further its goals along.
But bigger picture, what is their legacy 3 years after they took over Zuccotti Park?
Sure. So this is fascinating. I mean, I think back to the early days of Occupy Wall Street. And my bottom line here is that I think they actually have quite a bit to be proud of. I mean, remember the very early days we saw these striking visual images of protesters. I think a lot of the rhetoric that came from its leaders in the early days might have struck some people as a bit extreme. And yet the spirit of what they did, I think, is totally legitimate. I think we can see that now. The idea of or the problem of income inequality is now something close to a mainstream economic topic. I mean, it's as close as it gets, really. And they put their finger on this very, very early. The idea that income inequality isn't just a problem, isn't just a symptom of low economic growth. It's something that can actively harm it. It's a problem for all of us, not just for lower income or for poor people. And I think they got after it really early. One other thing they've done is that actually they were a serious part of the debate on how to influence financial reform. I would single out the group Occupy the SEC here. They've done a lot of work. I mean, they influenced the Volcker Rule. They've got a lot of members who formerly worked on Wall Street and in finance and know their stuff. They're not just some frivolous group that doesn't know what it's talking about. I think they do a lot of things that deserve to be taken seriously. And I don't think it was obvious in those early days of Occupy Wall Street exactly what would happen. So no, it's not this one big coherent mass of people protesting or occupying the park. But I think its legacy is actually fairly impressive.
But there are some who would say they didn't accomplish what they set out to accomplish. You've still got these big Wall Street banks doing a lot of the same things that they were doing before.
Sure. And we're now kind of, I don't think celebrating is the right word, lamenting maybe the 6-year anniversary of the fall of Lehman Brothers.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that Occupy members would probably be the first to tell you that they wish that financial sector reform had gone a lot further. The truth, though, is, I mean, you know, no group ever gets all that it wants. I mean, you know, Washington and the legislative process is essentially, you know, a big, you know, it's a big competition of people trying to enact change.
Right.
But I actually think that what Occupy has done, being a part of the conversation and being a serious and active participant, I still think it's something they should look back on and be impressed with.
Cardiff Garcia of the Financial Times on this day, 3 years since the Occupy Wall Street movement took over Zuccotti Park in New York City. Cardiff, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And NASA has awarded contracts to two private companies to develop space taxis that can ferry astronauts to the International Space Station. The companies are Boeing, which won a $4.2 billion contract, and Space Exploration Technologies, or SpaceX, which will get a $2.6 billion contract. Here's NASA Administrator Charles Bolden making the announcement yesterday.
Today's announcement sets the stage for what promises to be the most ambitious and exciting chapter in the history of NASA and human spaceflight.
The new vehicles are scheduled to begin operating in 2017 and would replace the Russian vehicles that the U.S. has relied on to get astronauts into space since the last NASA shuttle was retired in 2011. Pat Duggins is the author of two books on NASA. He joins us from Alabama Public Radio, where he is news director. Pat, great to have you.
Thank you, Jeremy. How are you?
I'm doing well. So tell us more about the significance of this, these two contracts that have been handed out.
Well, longtime space watchers will tell you it's kind of like, you know, the wheels of the gods grind slowly, because I was there in 2005 when George W. Bush said the shuttle program was going away. And the criticism at the time was that they were thinking about a replacement vehicle, but no substantial money. And now here we are almost 9 years later. They've signed the deal. So it's like, I guess, you know, better late than never.
So why split it between two companies then? Why do you give this big contract to Boeing, more than $4 billion, and then $2.6 billion for SpaceX?
Well, being a betting man, this is what I think. I wasn't in on the actual negotiations, obviously, but you've got two vehicles that really have not flown, two manned vehicles that haven't flown. You've got the Boeing vehicle, the CST-100, and then the Dragon variant that Elon Musk is talking about. Neither of these vehicles have gone. So if there is some kind of a disaster during development, or if there's some kind of a launch pad disaster with one of the designs, you've got the other. So what NASA is doing, basically, it appears, is that they're betting on two horses in the same race.
Hoping that one of them works out.
Yeah, basically.
And the losing bidder was Sierra Nevada Corp, which was the only one that was designing a winged vehicle, sort of like the shuttle that we used to have, something that could land on an airport runway. The two winners are not like that. Tell us about what they are and why the NASA people decided to go that direction instead of with a winged vehicle.
Well, I'm sure there's some astronaut pilots out that are going, aw, shucks, because the Dream Chaser didn't make it, because that would be the wind whistling through your hair kind of a thing with the pilot using the control stick to bring the vehicle in. And I think NASA may have just had a belly full of that with the space shuttle. I mean, I covered about 103 of those missions, and it was a magnificent vehicle, but very problematic. What they're doing now is basically, hey, let's go back to the future. Both of the vehicles that we're talking about, the Boeing vehicle and the SpaceX, are the gumdrop-shaped capsules that are familiar to anybody who's gone to the Smithsonian and seen the capsule that Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin and Mike Collins flew on. It's really simple. It's just, you know, the compartment with the heat shield on the bottom. It goes up. It comes down. None of the frills. It'll either plop in the ocean, or if they go the route that the Russians went with the Soyuz, it could actually possibly land on solid ground. But it's going to be a much less, you know, bells and whistles compared to what was the shuttle or the Dream Chaser was going to be.
Is that as safe as if you had a winged vehicle?
It's more direct, to be honest with you. When they went back to, like, you know, Project Mercury, and they were sending up like Gus Grissom and John Glenn and all those guys, the simplest way to get from here to there was simply to have the gumdrop shape and the heat shield, and that's all. With the space shuttle, I mean, there were the control surfaces, there were the tiles that could be damaged. I mean, you know, the Columbia disaster in 2003 because of that. So if you wanted to come up with something that's safe and that also you've got a lot of familiarity with, then the simple capsule up and back is probably the safest bet for NASA, especially since we're just talking about a space taxi. You go there, you come back, you're a lifeboat. That's basically it.
And how is this going to work with NASA working with these private companies? Do the companies build the rockets and then turn them over to NASA, or are they going to be the ones running the flights and sending the astronauts up to the space station?
Well, I haven't seen the contract yet, but it's kind of interesting. Technically, these guys are going to be working for NASA. In other words, NASA is the contractor. They are the customer. They're the one who's always right. And then people, Boeing, SpaceX, they're the provider of the service. Now, that's the question has come up earlier, does this open the door possibly to space tourism? Now, on Boeing's own website, they're already talking about, well, we're going to do all these great things for NASA, but there's always the possibility of that space hotel by Bigelow Aerospace that we may wind up supporting too. So it looks as though It's going to be for NASA. It's going to be for the astronauts. But if they can make a buck on the side, there's the possibility they might pursue that too.
Now, one of the storylines here is that NASA doesn't want to rely as much on the Russians, given what's going on right now between the U.S. and Russia. I spoke with somebody in the aerospace industry today who said, no, this has been in the works much longer. As you said, this is back in 2005. How much does the U.S.-Russian relations problem figure into what's happening?
Well, let's put it this way. If nothing else, the fact that, you know, Congress is getting upset because they have to go to Vladimir Putin hat in hand to send up astronauts, that always rankled Washington. That always was a big deal. But in terms of just the notion of having private corporations do this, if you go back to the movie classic 2001, A Space Odyssey, the space station there was operated by Hilton and the shuttle was operated by Pan Am. So even back in the mid-60s, people were talking about, hey, let big business make a buck in low Earth orbit. It's relatively easy. And then the space agency, the civilian space agency like NASA, we go off and do the cool, funky things like maybe go to Mars, go to the moon, do something like that.
I guess they just made the wrong bet on Pan Am there. That obviously is not going to be a contract.
That has
today.
Come up in conversation. Yes.
Well, why did they decide to go private on this and not keep it in-house? Is that a funding issue?
I think that what they're trying to do is kind of get big business to do what big business does best. In other words, there was a whole bunch of people that were fighting it out to try to get the contract. And what I think NASA was hoping for was a more practical vehicle, a less expensive vehicle to use, and basically get the job done and let these guys do it. And we'll pay them. They make a buck. And then we get to concentrate on something called Project Orion, which is a big rocket that they're building actually here in Alabama. It's called the Space Launch System. And on top of that is going to be a completely separate launch vehicle called the Orion, which looks suspiciously like Boeing's craft. And what NASA wants to do is utilize that really big, ambitious rocket and their own capsule to do something since they haven't done since 1972, and that's put astronauts out of low Earth orbit. We've been stuck in low Earth orbit since Project Apollo. So if we're going to do anything really, really interesting, we got to have a new big rocket. We have to have a big capsule. That's what NASA's doing over here while Boeing and SpaceX do the grunt work going up and back to the space station.
And we spoke with NASA Administrator Charles Bolden about this earlier this summer, and some of our listeners wrote in and asked afterwards, why isn't NASA working on sending out more Voyagers way out into space? Those are bringing back amazing images.
In my very first book, that was the Final Countdown. That was the deal that was brought up then, because you can do that with robotic vehicles. But since Congress provides the money, a congressman would rather stand next to an astronaut and get his picture taken than stand next to a space probe.
Pat Duggins, news director for Alabama Public Radio. His books on NASA are, as he said, their Final Countdown, NASA and the End of the Space Shuttle Program, and Trailblazing Mars. Both are now available as audiobooks. Pat, thanks as always.
Thank you so much, Jeremy.
And you're listening to Here and Now in 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Israel Horovitz always surprises us. The noted playwright has written more than 70 works, and he's the most produced American playwright in France. He also wrote the screenplay for the 1982 film Author, Author, starring Al Pacino as, well, a noted playwright.
I had a lousy day today. I've turned 42. I fired a director. I beat my kids. I forgot to beat my kids.
And a pillow fight ensues. Israel Horovitz also co-founded the Gloucester Stage Company here in Massachusetts. His son Adam grew up to be a Beastie Boy. That was fun. But now, at 75, Israel Horovitz has made a movie bringing his play My Old Lady to the screen. Kevin Kline stars as Matthias, a penniless, unraveling New Yorker. His estranged father dies and leaves him an old, rambling apartment in Paris worth millions. But in it is a lifelong tenant, Mathilde, played by Maggie Smith.
I eat dinner each night at precisely 8 o'clock. And breakfast is at precisely 8 a.m. I don't eat lunch. Lunch is not a meal that interests me.
Turns out he can't evict Mathilde because of the French system called Viager. In fact, as owner, he has to pay her a sum every month as long as she lives. It's kind of a reverse mortgage. But she allows him to stay, and over the course of the film, we delight in a perfect cast delivering the lines of one of the country's great playwrights. And Israel Horovitz joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin. I'm really happy to be on your show.
The system called Viager, where you buy an apartment for a lower price, but then you have to pay the tenant who's in it, who might have owned it previously, until they die. There's a little metaphor there for how everyone is yoked together.
Exactly. And I just thought it was barbaric. And then I came to realize it's not so bad. If somebody is very old and maybe indigent and they don't have kids, then they get a bunch of money and they get a kind of annuity and they can stay in their house.
Yeah.
I do say in the film, finally, if they die, it's your destiny to have their apartment. If they don't die, it's your destiny to pay to help them live. It's right. Very sweet.
Well, we don't want to give too much away, but suffice it to say, as Kevin Kline is waiting for this very older woman to perhaps exit, he gets to wander Paris, and we get to see things like people singing opera along the Seine. And that's the part of the film I'm imagining where you've said you want to make a love letter to Paris, and you do.
Well, I started out writing the play because I wanted to write a kind of Valentine or at least a thank you letter to France for giving me this French life. I've had 50-something of my plays produced there, and then I bumped into the Viager system, and so that was a kind of a start. And, of course, every time I write a play, I start out thinking I know exactly where it's going, and then, you know, midway through the writing, I say, isn't it interesting where this play is taking me? And my old lady probably isn't a Valentine in the end. Like most of my stuff, I think it's pretty funny in the beginning, and then it goes to a darker, more serious place.
There is an excruciating revelation about Kevin Kline's character. He starts off as kind of a ne'er-do-well, kind of funny guy, and then we learn about how his father treated him, how his father abandoned his mother. At one point, Kevin Kline sits and cries like the 10-year-old he must have been at one point. You, Israel Horovitz, have spoken about how your father beat you. Was this a chance to exercise a little of that?
Certainly not intentionally. Usually I'll do a play or a film and I'll look at it and then recognize something. I do want to say this. We've all in our lives, we know people who are in their 50s or 60s who are still talking about damage that their parents did to them. And there's a big piece of our brains that says, you know, get over it. But there's another piece of our brain that knows they'll never get over it.
Yeah. Well, Maggie Smith's character, Mathilde, is one of the people telling him to get over it. And I think we can say we learned pretty early on she was his father's lover. Where did you get Mathilde?
Mathilde is a character who I almost started from the cliché of the French person who's almost insanely romantic. And recently, literally in the last week, I remembered I was on a plane and there's a little old lady sitting next to me and she was so nervous and she every half minute she would say, "What's the matter? Why aren't we going? When do we take off?" And I opened my script and started to pretend that I was really busy to try to ignore her. And then I thought, come on, big shot, this could be your grandmother. What are you doing? So I put the script down and I turned to her and I hear my voice say this really banal, "It must be hot here in the summertime." And she said, "In the summer, when my husband was alive, we never stayed here. We always went to Sweden. He won a big prize in Sweden." She was the widow of Isaac Singer. Alma Singer. And I kept a relationship with her over a couple of years. After she died, I discovered this. She and Singer were married to other people, and they had a torrid love affair, and they decided not just to leave their spouses, but to leave their children, and created their own new marriage, and it was a very good one, and it went on for years and years and years. He predeceased her. She died, and she was buried next to Singer. Within a couple of weeks, Singer's children had his body exhumed and reburied next to their mother. Her children had her body exhumed and buried next to their father. And looking at my movie, I thought, well, I've invested this in Mathilde, in somebody who really has blinders on. Her love takes her to a place, and it's a great love.
Well, as we said at the outset, you always surprise us. And this, again, you know, hearing this story about Alma Singer, it's of course you would sit next to her and it would spiral the way it did and lead to this story. And as you say, you could have written a cliched story about French love, no problem, but you show the wake of...
Well, I think, right or wrong, I started with the premise that love is, in fact, at one point I wrote it down on the piece of paper and I had Kevin just read it and the sound man ran over and taped it. He says, "Love is a solid substance." In other words, you only have so much love to give. And when you give love to somebody new, you take it away from mm-hmm. somebody else. So you can say when you fall in love with somebody, you're going to hurt somebody else. There's mm-hmm. going to be some detritus.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, back to your own story. And again, the surprises that we trouble with your own dad. But then you say you went out and picked a father figure, which, you know, a lot of people do. But of course, yours was Samuel Beckett, the Irish poet and writer with the incredibly bleak outlook on life. So just tell us a little bit about your relationship with him, because at the end of the film, the son goes to the father's gravestone and there's a little saying from Beckett on it.
His influence on me wasn't so much his writing, but the way he lived his life. I had never met anybody in my life before or after with that kind of integrity. He really knew who he was. When he put pen to paper, he knew who he was. He knew what he was trying to do. And I should say now that he said to me loudly and clearly one day, in French, he said, "Un écrivain qui explique son écriture, c'est comme un escargot qui explique sa coquille." A writer who explains his writing is very much like a snail explaining his shell. And I think he was right. I know he was right.
I got the escargot part. What do you have? What do you have on the plaque on the father's headstone in your film? What is the Beckett's?
If you shall not love, if you do not love me, I shall not be loved. It's from a poem of Beckett's called Cascando. Mm. The whole quote is: "If you do not love me, I shall not be loved. If I do not love you, I shall not love." And I thought it was a kind of such a romantic thought that it fit the film.
Israel Horovitz, who directed the new film My Old Lady, based on his 2002 play. Israel, thank you so much for speaking to us.
I'm so happy to have been your guest today. Thanks, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.